Welcome to the Healthy, Wealthy, and Smart Podcast. Each week, we interview the best and brightest in physical therapy, wellness, and entrepreneurship. We give you cutting-edge information you need to live your best life, healthy, wealthy, and smart. The information in this podcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be used as personalized medical advice. And now, here's your host, Dr. Karen Litzy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you joining me today. And you are in for a treat in this episode. Today, I am joined by Dr. Ebony Rio. She is a physiotherapist and researcher with extensive experience in tendon pain. She is a postdoctoral researcher at La Trobe University and completed her PhD in tendon pain, researching corticospinal responses associated with patellar tendinopathy and the effect of externally paced strength training. Her research has changed rehabilitation practice around the world. She currently is involved in a variety of projects investigating tendon pain, especially in the lower limb. However, other areas, such as investigating innovative new rehabilitation techniques. Ebony also still consults clinically, having been previously involved at the Australian Institute of Sport, Australian Ballet, and the Winter Olympics. So today we're talking all about tendinopathy, a much debated and much talked about topic across social media and PT schools and clinical practices around the world. So in this episode, we discuss one of her recent papers. We discuss tendon neuroplastic training. We discuss motor cortex changes with tendon pain and the powerful role a metronome can play for your brain excitability, how to utilize time under tension and load to reduce tendon pain, and the importance of patient input for goal setting, and much, much more. I was absolutely thrilled to have Ebony on because she can break down some of these more complex issues within tendinopathy, make it very easily digestible so that everyone can, I think, get a better understanding of what tendinopathy is and how, as clinicians, we can treat it to the best of our abilities. So I really hope that you enjoyed today's episode. I took copious notes, and I have a feeling you will as well. I also want to give a special thank you to Scott Morrison for sending over some really thoughtful questions to ask Ebony, which I did ask them all, I swear. So thanks again to Dr. Ebony Rio, and enjoy today's episode all about tendinopathy. Hey, Ebony, welcome to the podcast. I am so happy to have you on.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to do this, and I love that we've been chatting for about 36 minutes before we've even gotten started.
I know. It happens all the time. So today we're going to be talking about tendinopathy. There were so many questions, so many topics to go into, so we are just going to jump right in. And can you explain tendon neuroplastic training? And then we will take it from there.
Okay. So the concept of tendon neuroplastic training is around treating all of the levels of dysfunction. So rather than having an approach which really focuses on, you know, the pathology in the tendon or right up at the other end and just considering pain science, it's really using what we know about tendon, where we need to load tendon to get a response, and we need to load muscle and do that in a specific way to get a response. And it's important to distribute load across the kinetic chain. So we need to, you know, think about that. And then starting to incorporate the ideas of motor control and differences in motor drive to the muscle that might be altered in people with tendon pain. How can we sort of modify our rehabilitation so that we are doing a loading protocol, because load is going to be the only thing that changes all of those levels of dysfunction. But what can we learn from neuroscience about how we load? So what parameters, what changes motor drive, what's the best stimulus at all of those different levels, and even incorporating things in like cross-education. So the concept of strength training one side and getting crossover to the affected side, which is a really great strategy, especially early on when people have tendon pain and we really struggle to load, we can get some great gains by cross-education. So tendon neuroplastic training is the term, and Kay Copeland, I'm complete credit to her for the name, and It's the concept of a rehabilitation program that addresses tendon, muscle, kinetic chain, and brain, using hopefully the latest research across all of those domains to address a really complex condition.
So much more comprehensive than what was there before, you know, because oftentimes when you ask someone about how do you treat a tendinopathy, they say eccentrics.
And that's been the mainstay. And one of the fantastic things about the eccentric research and heavy slow resistance and everything that's been done in the past has given us stepping stones to say load is our primary modality. Load and exercise, and you know, we can debate a little bit about how we apply that. But the great thing about all of that research is that it demonstrates that load is our most effective treatment for tendinopathy, and that's true. And so tendon neuroplastic training, the idea is not to throw everything out. It's to say, well, let's put those things in context, and can we finesse it? Can we say, well, eccentrics are critical, like athletic activity involves eccentric work, you know, fast energy storage and release. We need that stuff in there. But does that in isolation address some of the motor cortex changes? It appears it doesn't. So how can we build on it and really, you know, keep moving our rehabilitation forward, because we're not winning the battle with tendinopathy. We're not winning the battle with musculoskeletal pain. It's so common. It's increasingly common. It's something that we all treat. So yeah, it was let's go away from a recipe, but let's use these wonderful concepts of load and how we might build that in to a new paradigm, I guess.
You had just mentioned sort of motor cortex changes that may happen with tendinopathy. Can you expand that a little bit? What have you guys seen?
Sure. So we completed a study where we found, probably by complete accident, and it was the absolute opposite of my hypothesis, and it was my first study in my PhD. So my hypothesis was that I would find nothing. And what I did is I looked at the drive to the quadriceps muscle. And the way you do that is you use a non-invasive technique and you put a magnetic coil over the motor cortex, and it's based on your motor homunculus, your little representation of you in the brain, so that each movement is represented. So what we can do is we can find the region that represents your leg extensors, and we put surface electrodes on your quadricep muscle, and essentially we give you a zap. And the zap travels down your spinal cord, and it's recorded as a twitch in your target muscle. And what we do is we can change the parameters of the machine to look at the control. And the control is made up of two parts, the excitability and the inhibition. And you can think of the excitability and inhibition like the brake and accelerator of a car. It's a really easy way to think about it, where every action is a balance between those things. And so in the first study of my PhD, I thought, okay, we're getting people with patellar tendon pain on the leg extension, on the Biodex, and they're doing a 10% contraction while we test them. So they won't be in pain. That's not painful for someone with patellar tendinopathy. So because they won't be in pain, we'll find nothing, because there's great research in experimental pain literature that shows, you know, if people are in pain while you're testing, there's a difference in their motor cortex. So hypothesis, we'll find nothing. What we found, and this is what we found by complete accident, because I'd blinded myself in the research to whether or not they had knee pain or not, what I ended up with was not just people with what we would call patellar tendinopathy and a focal inferior pole pain. We ended up with people with this vague anterior knee pain as well. So, you know, fat pad, patellofemoral, you know, we can debate the diagnosis, but they had diffuse pain. So we had all of a sudden a control group, and our control group were young jumping men with no pain or no pathology. So the level of detail in this study was that everyone had an ultrasound and as well to make sure they didn't even have any pathology, because I didn't know what the effect of pathology might be on their motor cortex. Then the people with patellar tendinopathy had unilateral pain and pathology. So their other tendon was completely clear and no pain. And then we had our anterior knee pain group. And when I was looking at the results and analyzing it all blinded, I was like, man, there's a whole group where I'm just not sure what's going on. And then when I unblinded it and had a look, the control group had this lovely sigmoidal curve where the more you turn up the machine, they had this graded response. It's what we see in the literature. And the patellar tendon group had nothing, 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 bang. They switched everything on and then they plateaued. They had what we term in neuroscience increased excitability. So their accelerator was on or off. It was, there was no modulation. And then this is the part for me that's really fascinating. The people with diffuse anterior knee pain had the same curve as the control group. So they, it wasn't just having pain at the front of the knee that resulted in this change in motor cortex. It was actually unique to the people that had inferior pole pain. So I could zap your brain and tell you whether or not you had diffuse or focal pain, which I think is fascinating because if we consider tendon neuroplastic training, again, it should not be a recipe that we apply to all knee pain because the changes that we're going to see in people that have different conditions could be different for their motor cortex. And in fact, our research would say that they appear to be different. So it's critical that our rehab as we go forward becomes much more tailored to what we're seeing in front of us.
And I love that concept of the break and the acceleration. And how does that then carry over into practical clinical work?
So the way that carries over is I looked at the curves and the physio in me said, ooh, I wonder if our rehabilitation actually does anything about that. So we know we need to strength train and we need to load, but if we just go and do our rehabilitation, if we just go and do exercise, do we change that brain curve? And that's when I started looking in the neuroscience literature. And then the physio in me wanted to design something that tried to address those differences. And I knew it has to be exercise-based, you know. All of the research shows that loading is going to be our best intervention, that none of our passive therapies are going to change those things. It's not to say they might have a role in changing pain, but the way that carries over into clinical practice is to say, how as physios can we actually understand just a little bit of neuroscience to address those changes with some really simple things like the metronome while we're getting people to strength train. So even though the science can be really complex, the actual implementation of it is super simple.
And so let's talk about the metronome, because I am kind of fascinated by this entire concept of the auditory cues using the metronome. Like we said when we were chatting before, I spoke to Tasha Stanton about the paper that they did using auditory cues to discern back stiffness, quote unquote. Can you explain that whole metronome situation and auditory cues and how that works?
So to answer that, I'll summarize a great study by Mike Luong, and this is published in Neuroscience 2015. And he showed that if you do self-paced strength training, which is where you go off to the gym and complete your exercises and the music might be blasting, you might be thinking about what you're having for dinner, you know, checking out the cute guy, all of those things. Even if you're focused on what you're doing, if you're pacing it yourself, that you'll get changes at a muscle level, you'll get stronger, but you actually don't change the excitability and inhibition. You don't change your brake and your accelerator. If you look at some of the studies that have been done, and Mike did this as well, where people copy a skilled task, and a common one that's used, it's called visuomotor tracking. And what that means is you'll copy a screen where there's some sort of limb or segment, and you're copying the movement for the pace, for the range of motion. So you're really focused on what you're doing, and you know your little visual system's linked up to your motor system, and it's all humming. And what you get doing a task like that, or even some sort of Purdue pegboard, you get a ton of changes to your brake and your accelerator. Then So a simple way that we can combine the concept of skill but the benefit of exercise is to use a metronome when people are doing their exercises. Now, the benefit from the muscle point of view is you guarantee the time under tension that you're after for your concentric and eccentric phase and all of those parameters. But what you actually get, because the little interneurons between your auditory cortex and your motor cortex fire up and your frontal lobe fires up with planning and execution, you get this great involvement of your brain that changes your brake and your accelerator. So you'll optimize your exercise, but what you also get is the changes to the brake and the accelerator. Now, people often ask, what about the auditory cues? Like, what do you need to do? So there's a couple of things that I found in the research. It needs to be 60 beats per minute fired up both sides of the brain. So that's why we did 60 beats per minute. You need a slightly longer eccentric phase for to involve the frontal lobe in terms of the planning stuff to make the task complex. So for the leg extension, for example, we do 3 seconds up, 4 seconds down. And so every decision we made in TNT had a reason. Every single decision that was made had a reason. And so people will say, can you use music? And I think it's a great question. And you possibly can, but the key thing about the metronome is that it's actually the anticipation, it's the tempo and the regularity. So what you can't have is a piece of music blasting at you, but if you had a piece of music that had the right tempo or that you knew the piece very well, it's highly likely, and especially in performers like ballet dancers, and there's probably some great opportunities, but can you sit there and self-pace? The research would say no. If you want to change your brake and your accelerator, can you listen to music, blasting at you? No.
No. Yeah. And it's so you answered every question that I was going to have as a follow-up with that. So that was
sorry.
Great. You're like 5 steps ahead. Because I was going to ask about the beats per minute and things like that. So that makes a lot of sense. Thank you for that. Why the 2-minute rest between isometric bouts? Why are they 45 seconds? So if you want to kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So the original study that I did was a laboratory-based study because I had some really specific questions and I was interested in the mechanism. So Jill Cook and Craig Purdom had been playing around with using isometrics clinically. And so my research question was, well, what load could we apply that might reduce pain that we might be able to use right before you run out on the field, for example? Now, again, the fact that isometrics helped pain immediately was found completely by accident when I was pilot testing. So not all great research is born out of, there's a little bit of luck involved. So the way this research developed was I wanted to say, was there something special about isometrics? Are we just warming it up? So to do that, I needed to compare it to something. So what I did was I spent 18 months pilot testing for this study. And in that 18 months, I pilot tested very short duration holds of 90 and 100% of MVC, which people can really only sustain for 3 or 5 seconds. And the reason why I pilot tested that is I wanted to look at the effect of isometrics and isotonics on strength. But if my outcome measure was affecting their analgesia, if they were getting pain relief from doing that, then I couldn't be sure it was my isometric or isotonic. It could be my test. So I needed to test that in isolation. And what I found is it did nothing for pain. So that's great. We've got a start point. There's no point doing very, very short duration holds, not effective for pain. Okay. Then as part of my testing for the brain zapping, I needed people to be able to hold very low MVC quad contraction holds for several minutes. So I needed to test that because if doing the TMS testing, if me zapping their brain or getting them to hold, 10% MVC for 2 minutes, if that changed their pain, then again, I couldn't attribute the pain relief to the isometric or isotonic, it would just be my protocol. So I had to test all of these things in isolation for 18 months. And then what I did was I started whittling down to get the combination of time under tension and load. So what I found was short duration, very heavy, not effective. Long duration, 10, 20, 30, not effective for tendon pain. So then I kept coming together until I found, the sweet spot, and found that 5 by 45 seconds at 70% was really where we're at. And then what I had to do was match the isotonic, because if they weren't matched for rating of perceived exertion or time under tension or rest or any of those things, then maybe it was just that one group did more or less load. So everything had to be perfectly matched to be able to say this is better than this, or they're no different, or whatever, you know, was going to become of it. Then I thought, okay, if I'm going to look at this properly, tendon pain is really intimately related to load. I need to get athletes that have done the same loading. I need stability of loading so that when they come in the morning, their load test and TMS, you have to test the same time of day because there's differences in circadian rhythms. Mm-hmm. So I came up with a protocol, which was 3 weeks long, where athletes had to come in 3 weeks in a row at the same time of day. You know, we monitored caffeine intake, anything that changes their excitability and inhibition, tested their decline squat, measured their loading the week before. The first week was a pure baseline just to retest everything again. If I get people into the lab in this study, is their pain going to change just because, you know, I'm a nice person and, you know, I'm being very friendly.
And they're in a study.
Exactly. And they're in a study. You know, we can't underestimate stuff like that. And so what we need to do in research is do our best to measure it. So I had a complete baseline week. And then a week later, a baseline measure of everything again. And same with the third week. That way I could make sure there was a complete washout. Now, the reason why I went with a crossover is your response to something, to two different protocols, is your response. Like, we're talking pain here. And so I could have two groups, but it could just be that, like, that group is different. They loaded differently. Their knee pain was different to start with. They rate pain differently. If I'm getting you to rate your pain each time and I'm comparing you to you. So again, that's why we made the decision to do a crossover study. So then what I did was the person doing the TMS and all of the outcome measures, everyone was blinded. So no one knew what was going on. Everyone had a script, because again, if I say to you, I'm going to put you in the study and it's awesome, and this one's really going to change your pain. This one's awesome. You know, you're priming people. So there was a script for the isometric and isotonic condition. So they heard the same thing every time. I'm a nice person, but I was a nice person 3 weeks in a row. So there's some consistency in some of the things that we think are important. Then again, all of that was not only collected, but analysed, blinded to group. So I acknowledge it's a small study of six people, but geez, I challenge anyone to do it again. Like,
it sounds,
you could
like
not pay me to do it again. It was
amazing.
So what I went for was attention to detail. Attention to detail, and so that I could answer the key at the end of the day, it was still clinical questions. I just tried to answer it as systematically as I thought I could. So my question was, what load could I do right before I ran out on the field? And to answer that, I need to know what the effect is on your muscle performance, because if I make your pain better, but your muscle is so completely fatigued that you go and injure yourself, you're not happy, the coach is not happy. So I needed to measure, muscle strength before and after. I was interested in the brain stuff, and I was interested in their pain response. So that's why they were the outcome measures of the study. So that's why there were only six, because it was all kinds of horrific to do. And then I thought from there, you know, what we can do is then start to look at the I always get it mixed up, you know, the efficacy and efficiency or something. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know how one is in a lab and then one's a bit more population? Yeah, so obviously the lab-based one is lab-based, and then we need to look at how it might be used. And that's where the next study came out. So I had people contact me and go, well, that's great, but I actually can't access a leg extension machine because I play tennis and we travel the world and, you know, the gym availability is different. And that's why we started doing the squat. So Angle Bassis uses the belted squat, and we turned that into an isometric study and looked at isometrics on the road, and it's just been accepted.
Nice. That's awesome. Yep. Congratulations.
Clinical Journal Sports Med. Thank you.
Awesome. Yep. Awesome. Now, some people have gyms in their buildings where they have a leg extension machine, but some people don't. And listen, most PT places in New York City don't have robust gyms and things like that. So it's good to know that there are ways. So with the band, like a Spanish squat type of a situation?
Absolutely. So yeah. We wanted something, you need options for people are traveling or they're at their home and all of that sort of thing. So even though it's double leg, it's really hard. Like
it's super hard. I know.
It's super hard. And you change how hard it is by how deep you are in the squat. Mm-hmm. Yep. So the tibia is upright, your feet are against something, so you're really safe. It's a continuous loop, not something with a seatbelt, so that it's really safe and people sit back. So we called it isometrics on the road, and that's what we did. I didn't answer your question about the rest period. Did you want me to answer that?
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
And I just got on roll.
No, that was awesome. I should say that this question in particular is from Scott Morrison. So he's a PT out in Portland. I don't know if you know Scott, but yeah, so that was his, was why the 2-minute rest between bouts. Others are doing 1-minute rest bouts, but that seems to be more for a physiological effect versus a cortical effect. So
that's a great question. Yes. So I get asked that question a bit. So again, the original research question was, what could I do right before my athlete ran out on the field? So I wanted complete muscle recovery. I wanted no central fatigue because I wanted to know what could I do that would not impair their performance. So I looked at the research, and you need sort of at least 60 to 90 seconds for the physiological recovery. So I did 2 minutes just to give myself an absolute buffer. Clinically, we shorten it right up. So we traditionally might do, say you're going to do an isometric on your right leg, you'll then do your isotonic on your left leg. So you're 3 seconds up, 4 seconds down. If you do 4 lots of 8, that's 45 seconds. By the time you change your weights, you've had a minute rest, you go straight onto the other side. Could you get up and make a cup of tea, do a different exercise? Absolutely. You don't have to sit there and do nothing. So we would tend to go left leg, right leg, and just alternate through, and that works out at about a minute, and that's been fine. And that's actually what we did with the RCT.
Okay.
Was left leg, right leg. So there's a minute in that study and they were fine.
And that was the sort of add-on to that question was, can you do something else during this time? Now, can you do something else during that time on the same side? Or do you want like an isometric in a different, so let's say, can you do an isometric in a different direction?
Yep.
Or do you want to just be complete rest for that one limb?
Not at all. And so, you know, honestly, the tennis athletes would do their Spanish squat or their Catalonian squat, mm-hmm. I believe Angle calls it. So they would do their squat, they do a bit of warm up, they do their squat. They're not resting, they're incorporating it in. So no, you don't have to sit there and do nothing. You can get going with the rest of your program.
Okay.
And I think that's such a great point, because adherence is really important, and barriers to adherence are, it takes too long. But if you're using this within your training program and doing other things, you know, it's really not blowing out how long it takes you.
Right. So you can be efficient with that time and you can do other stuff in between, which I think is important because, I think you might lose some people if they're just like have to sit there. I mean, I guess they can go on Twitter or something or Facebook for 2 minutes, but probably not if you're an athlete in training for your upcoming season. Okay, so that was all great. Thank you so much. There were some other things about, but I think you sort of answered them, isometrics versus eccentric, concentric exercises. And I think we answered what does isometrics do that maybe concentrics and eccentrics don't do. And it seems from what you just said, and please correct me if I'm hearing this, but it seems like you're having a little bit more analgesic effect or pain control with the isometrics that you might have then as compared to eccentric concentrics.
Correct. So okay. The immediate effect of isometric was more, there was a greater magnitude of pain response and it lasted for longer. And again, in the study, we only tested for 45 minutes because I was zapping these guys for about 3 hours. And my regret of that study was to not get them to score their pain later that day and all of that stuff, because clinically we see that isometrics can help for 2 to 8 hours. But in the study, we only tested for 45 minutes. So we've seen in our RCT and also that study that they have a greater effect on pain. But isotonics also reduce pain, not to the same magnitude. So clinically, we have two options, and that's really important. And also clinically, they both have a role. So isometrics should not be the only thing we do. And I see it as a way in. So when you see someone with pain, we need a way in. And as physios, we've got some really great tools. We've got education. We've got some of our adjuncts like tape. You know, we've got some of our manual therapy. I see isometrics as another opportunity for tendon pain to reduce people's pain. You reduce their pain, you get them on board. You know, it's a real win for adherence and it's a real win for a loading program. And that's ultimately what they're going to need. So you actually get them started on something that is loading, but it's great for self-efficacy because they're doing it themselves. It reduces their pain and that really helps their adherence as well. So, you know, I'm very pragmatic. Try it. If it works, great. Try it. If it doesn't work, don't use it.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got other options. And now one thing that, so I saw you speak in Monaco at the IOC and then hunted you down like a crazy stalker because I really enjoyed your talk very much. And one thing that you had said during the talk is like, can we all please stop poking the tendons? Like you don't have to poke the tendons. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So these two times that we like to poke a tendon. And the first one is in diagnosis. Now, the problem with poking something to confirm a diagnosis is that Jill showed in 2001 that asymptomatic tendons, so people without tendinopathy or tendon pain, it hurts to poke, that athletes can have tendons that are a bit more sensitive. And then when I was hunting around in the pain literature, I found that the patellar tendon was the most sensitive structure in people with knee osteoarthritis. So great, it's super sensitive poking, but not specific, because if you're poking a tendon as your diagnosis, you're going to be diagnosing patellar tendinopathy in your 80-year-old lady. And that's not appropriate because she doesn't have patellar tendinopathy. She doesn't use her patellar tendon like a spring. So the problem with palpation is that it is non-specific. Lots of things are going to hurt to poke. And that's a problem clinically because people will, you know, go in for the tendon, poke it, confirm it and move on. Whereas in patellofemoral pain, OA, it's going to be a sensitive spot. It's an issue in research because we've probably got highly heterogeneous groups in our research because people have imaged it and poked it and they're in, and that's a real challenge. So we don't use it in diagnosis. People, students that I teach get very nervous about that. And I say, don't worry, I do put my hands on patients. It's really critical, but it's for things like checking for a knee joint effusion. Because if you have a knee joint effusion, it's not your patellar tendon that's giving you trouble because the tendon is extra articular. So what I try and do is teach students how you might, you know, use those skills. Our hands are incredibly important. Poking's just not that useful when it comes to diagnosis. Then in terms of prognosis, there's no evidence that more or less pain to poke gives you any information about how long it's going to take. And in fact, people that kind of keep poking it, I tell my patients it's like a bruise. It actually just keeps it a bit sensitive. So the worst are like the boys with the patella tendons because they can reach them so easily, the elbow tendons. People are just, you know, poking them the whole day. So it actually keeps it a bit sensitive. It's a terrible outcome measure because it's the last thing to get better. So how miserable for people if their pain to poke is what they're going by. What we want to go by is how's your life? We want to go with patient-based outcome measures as opposed to pain to poke. So we tell people stop poking it and, yep, your pain will probably – they'll think you're a genius because their pain will improve.
Right. Wow, it's amazing. And now how about when it comes to from the clinician standpoint of treating the tendon with poking? Yeah, I guess that's what cross-friction massage, if you're doing that over the tendon, right? You're kind of constantly poking at it.
Good question. So I had a bit of a hunt around and the research on the different techniques, cross-friction, mm-hmm. but also some of the instrumented stuff, it's really anecdotal. Like there's not a lot of research that actually supports it, especially when it's compared to anything else. Mm-hmm. So it's highly anecdotal. So what I would say is it fits really nicely in Jill's wheel of tendons. So she talks about adjuncts, and at the core of what we do should be our loading and, you know, education and capacity and all of that stuff. And all of the other adjunctive therapies might give us something, and if they do, fantastic. If you find someone that this is a technique that is helpful, great, knock yourself out. The problem is for an irritated tendon, so for a reactive tendon or a reactive on degenerative tendon, it's actually likely to make them actually more irritated because they're highly sensitive. They're already really sore. So people ask about cross frictions and also dry needling and say, oh, but I get really good results. And what I would say is you must be really good at picking your patient and picking who you're going to get a good result in, because inevitably people in courses report that I saw this patient, it was really useful. So we use massage techniques and dry needling in the muscle, but we don't use it in the tendon because it doesn't fit with what we think is going on at a tendon level. And clinically, I would be worried I'd make someone worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. And now can we take these sort of concepts? I mean, we've been talking here about your study, we were talking about patellar tendinopathy. Can we take these concepts that you've found with your studies and obviously Jill, and can we extrapolate them to other tendons across the body? Because people obviously have more than just patellar tendinitis, you know? So can we take these and say, because this works here, it can work elsewhere?
Good question. I think what we need to do is we always need to challenge ourselves and look at how you can apply the concepts and which ones hold up and which ones don't. Clinically, we do use the general concepts based on the idea of capacity, where you take someone's current capacity. This was Jill and Sean's editorial, and you look at their required capacity and then you implement the steps. So we traditionally do start with isometrics because most people come for pain. So that's a good starting point, but it's not all they get. You know, they get their strength training for the rest of their leg, strength training for the rest of the kinetic chain on the other side. Then people need to be strong. You know, you need to be strong enough to do whatever your goals are. So then they would traditionally go into a concentric, eccentric program. And then the next phase of what they do is based on what do you want to do. For the Achilles tendon, for example, we need to train a little bit of springiness because people need to step down off curbs and walk up and down stairs, so change direction quickly. So we use these concepts of graded loading across different tendons. We clinically and also in research, we're about to do a study in the Achilles tendon. We do use the 5x45, but I don't think we can ever just apply everything as a recipe. And the example would be GlutMeet. So we see people with GlutMeet tendinopathy, your older postmenopausal women, and they can't hold for 5 by 45 seconds. So what I want clinicians to do is be really thoughtful and to look at what the person in front of them can do. So we look for two things. Is it so easy they could do it all day? Well, we need to find a way to add load. Is it so hard that it's actually no longer isometric and they're getting a bit of perturbation? Well, we need to change load or time under tension. So the classic would be the glute med. You know, we frequently don't do 5 by 45. And then you've got different tendons like the Achilles where you can apply a load in sitting, but it's nowhere near the load you can get on it in standing. So we do a standing load unless someone is really underloaded. You know, someone's been immobilized, for example, we might need to do a seated calf raise, but it would never be our go-to. Same with the elbow. We'd never do wrist extension because you can't get enough load. Mm. The lever's not big enough. We do an isometric with a broomstick. So Jeremy's got some great stuff. So you do it into, you know, your supination, your pronation, as opposed to your extension and flexion for your elbow tendons. So thinking about how to get load on the different tendons is important, and the concepts might be applicable, but there's no recipes.
Yeah, there's no cookie cutter recipe. You can't say, well, I do step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 with every patient with a tendinopathy and I'm good.
And I'm good. Yep.
We're done. Yeah. No, that's great. And thank you for kind of going through those steps and those concepts. And this is a highly debated topic amongst physiotherapists. Certainly, I've seen a couple of interesting exchanges on social media about tendinopathy. And I think that what you've presented today, in my opinion, one of the biggest things is to look at the entire person. What does that person want to do? What do they need to do? What is their current capacity and where do they need to go? What do you hope that your students take away from your work on tendinopathy?
Assess the person in front of you, because that gives you their goals. So listen to them. That gives you the provocative load, and that's the load you need to take away first. So listen to them. Assess the person in front of you objectively, because that gives you your to-do list of what you need to do to get there. Listen to them about what's worked and what hasn't worked. Thirdly, I'm super passionate about differential diagnosis or subgrouping for a good outcome. So we can all debate what we think is tendinopathy or not. You know, we feel like it's a subgroup of pain, and within that subgroup it's got some specific aggravating factors relating to load and relating to pain specificity. And so we would say there's two critical questions for our students: where's the pain and what aggravates the pain? And that's because the pain remains highly localized, and critically that it remains localized with high tendon load for that tendon. So when you're asking that tendon to store and release energy like a spring. So listen to your patients, establish a really good diagnosis, and then be really thoughtful about how you're going to get there. How are you going to grade up and break down the steps of what they need to get them there? And that's why there's no recipe, because the same thing can't possibly work for the person that wants to walk around a golf course and Usain Bolt. You know, we can't possibly apply the same recipe to different people. So, yep, and that's a real challenge in research. Our research outcomes are usually time-based. Our outcomes when we're seeing patients, they're function-based. Our patients don't come to us for a 4-week trial. Our patients come to us because they want to run again, and regardless of how long that takes.
Yeah, and I think that is great advice and a wonderful breakdown on to how we can thoughtfully look at our patients and take them from eval to hopefully back to what they want to do. And on that note, I've got one question left for you, and it's a question that I ask everyone, and that is, knowing where you are now in your career and in your life, what advice would you give yourself as a new graduate right out of physio school?
Say yes to stuff even if on the inside you're thinking there's absolutely no way I can pull that off. So keep saying yes to stuff, because there are great people around you that give you opportunities and they believe in you sometimes more than you believe in yourself. But if they want to give you that opportunity, say yes and yep.
Yeah. And I love that. I think that's great advice. And I've certainly tried to do as much of that as I possibly can at times. And it, I think that it certainly led me down a path that I didn't ever think that I would take. I don't know. Do you feel the same way?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time and talking about tendinopathy. And I'm sure you can talk for hours and hours. Now, are you, you're going to be in Bern, right? So when, what are the dates on that in case people are interested?
Yep. So it's the Friday, the 25th of November. And we're so excited. So Mario's invited us over to Bern, and I love chocolate. So I'm very, very excited. And I hear it's a lovely place of the world, and the lineup looks great.
It looks amazing. Yeah.
You know, Perds, so Craig Purdom has technically retired. It's a soft retirement, but I would never pass up the opportunity to listen to Jill and Craig. And I've heard them so much, and I learn something every single time I listen to them.
Thank you for coming on to the podcast. And I know people are going to get a lot out of this. And if they have any questions or anything like that, is there a way that people can get in touch with you?
Sure. They can always email. I don't check Twitter anymore, but they're very welcome to email me, e.rio@latrobe.edu.au. I can be a bit slow, but I will always reply, and I'm really happy if people want more information. There's also the La Trobe Sport and Exercise Medicine Centre. So Christian Barton and Liam West do a brilliant job with the blogs for that, and they're really looking at putting out a lot of infographics and free resources for patients and clinicians. So that would be worth people checking. It talks about new research we've got coming out, but they're always hounding us to put stuff on there. So in the nicest possible way.
I'm
so
sure.
Yeah, it is a great resource, actually.
It is. Yep. No, it's a wonderful resource. I go to that quite often. I think they do a great job. Okay. Well, thanks so much for coming on. Everybody,
you.
Anytime. You can come back anytime you want. And everyone, thanks so much for listening. We'll have links to everything that we spoke about at podcast.healthywealthysmart.com under this episode. So thanks for tuning in. Have a great week and stay healthy, wealthy, and smart.
Thank you for listening, and please subscribe to the podcast at podcast.healthywealthysmart.com. And don't forget to follow us on social media.